Hey everyone, this is Jillian, and I have a big announcement before we get into today's show. I am so excited to announce that Court Junkie is now partnering with the Law and Crime Network. And starting next week, I will be releasing weekly episodes. That's right. If you're subscribed to Court Junkie, you'll be getting a brand new episode in your feed every Monday. So how did this all come about? Well, a few months back, my husband and I were watching live PD, like we do most Friday and Saturday nights, when I suggested that he reach out to Dan Abrams, the host of Live PD and also the founder and publisher of the Law and Crime Network. My husband handles the business side of this podcast, and I wanted him to see if law and crime would be interested in somehow working together. A few phone calls, emails, and contracts later, and we have decided to form a partnership. With Court Junkie covering legal cases and trials on the podcast, and with Law and Crime covering trials from all over the country on both YouTube and lawandcrime.com, I couldn't have dreamed of a better fit. So what does that mean for my Court Junkie listeners? Well, in addition to now being able to publish new episodes every week, I will also have access to Law and Crime's extensive trial library and accomplished legal experts, something I am really excited about. You guys know that content is important to me, and I'm so excited that I'm going to be able to up my game, so to speak. And don't worry, it's a partnership. So I'm still in charge of all of my research, all of my content, choosing which cases to cover and when, etc. I'll just be having a lot more help, which will enable me to do this on a more frequent basis. Many of you Court Junkies are probably already familiar with the Law and Crime Network if, like me, you've ever searched for a trial on YouTube. But here's my first legal expert on the pod, Dan Abrams, to tell you more. So first, can you tell me about Law and Crime and why you started it?
Well, I felt that there was a vacuum. I had worked at Court TV in the early days, and I remember the passion that people had for live trials. And I knew there was a way to do it better than had been done back then with new technology, with social media, with a lot of the changes that have occurred. And it also, after having hosted and executive produced Live PD on A&E now for a while, I saw that people were willing to wait for the outcome. It didn't need to be always highlights and this is the most amazing moment that just happened, that people want to follow the storyline. And I think for all of those reasons, I said, you know, we need Law and Crime Network. And that's why I started it.
Absolutely. And that's awesome because that's actually kind of one of the reasons why I started Court Junkie. So it's perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
True.
So what do you think is the most interesting trial you've covered so far on Law and Crime?
That's a tough one. There have been so many interesting cases. But one I think that you're going to be touching on is the Scandarito case, which
yes.
I think is super interesting, which is son out with his father, ends up chopping up his father's body, but then says he didn't kill him, that he was just scared he'd get blamed because they were together out partying. Very similar to what we saw in the first Robert Durst case back in the late, I think it was the late 90s, where he was accused of shooting someone who lived nearby to him, of killing someone who lived nearby and chopping up his body. He said the same thing, which was, yes, I chopped up his body, but I didn't kill him. And in the Durst case, it worked. And so really interesting case, and particularly interesting because in the Scandarito case, it just didn't seem to have any motive either. I mean, it wasn't like longstanding bad blood between them or anything. So really interesting case that I know you're going to be touching on.
Now, can you give me a preview of some upcoming trials that Law and Crime will be covering?
Yeah. So Durst is actually one of them, as it turns out, for the killing of Susan Berman. I think that's coming up in September, the Robert Durst trial. And she, remember, is the one who sort of knew everything about Robert Durst. And this is from a long time ago. And that should be a really interesting case. We've got a love triangle case, which is a Sidney Moore case, accused of kidnapping Heather Elvis and killing her. Body was never found. That Florida State University professor, Dan Markle, mm-hmm. who was shot pulling out of his garage, that got a lot of national attention. That trial's coming up, retrial for Kellen Winslow, the NFL star, because there was a hung jury on a number of the charges there. So we got a whole bunch of interesting cases coming up.
Cases that I am really excited to be covering. Now that my big announcement is out of the way, on to today's episode. Today's case goes back to Monday, November 11th, 1985. to the parking lot of D'Angelo's sandwich shop in Brockton, Massachusetts. A little after 10:30 p.m., police officers responded to a call of shots fired. Someone had been shot in the parking lot, and the shooter had fled the scene. When they arrived, they found 43-year-old Guillermo Rodriguez lying on the ground. He had been shot in the stomach and was rushed to Brockton Hospital. Police arrived at the scene fairly quickly, given that the Brockton Police Department was only about a block away. As they began their investigation into what happened, they interviewed eyewitnesses, of which there seemed to be many, and canvassed the area. The shooter was long gone by that time, but the eyewitnesses were able to give somewhat of a consistent description. The shooter was a shorter black male. Robert Kanikolas, owner of a local bar called the Colonial Spa, which was right near where the shooting had occurred, told police that at about 10:30 that night, he had noticed a black man in the bar, which he said was unusual. The next morning, he found a handgun in the trash in the men's room. Ballistics testing would later show that this was the same gun that had been used in the shooting. 3 days later, Guillermo Rodriguez died from his injuries. This was now a murder case. As the investigation continued, one name kept popping up. Darrell Diamond Jones, an 18-year-old who had been in the area that night. Darrell didn't know it then, but his name in relation to this murder would continue to be brought up again and again. In fact, he would spend 32 years in prison before having his conviction vacated, according to the judge's ruling, due to police tampering with evidence and racial bias among the jurors. In 2016, Darrell was released, but then he was accused all over again. This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 80. Nowadays, a lot of workplaces offer some pretty cool perks. A snack station, a place to play video games, 15 flavors of soda water, even insurance. But while it's nice to have a handful of trail mix and some really fancy tasting water, that's not enough to subsist on. And neither is your workplace life insurance. This is where Policy Genius comes in. Policy Genius is the easy way to shop for life insurance online. In minutes, you can compare quotes from top insurers to find the right amount of coverage at the best possible price, which really helps when you have no idea what you're doing, like myself and my husband. And Policy Genius doesn't just make life insurance easy. They can also help you find the right home insurance, auto insurance, and disability insurance. So remember, workplace life insurance policies are like workplace snacks. Better than nothing, but not quite enough. Head on over to policygenius.com today and find out how to supplement your workplace life insurance and better protect your family. Policy Genius, it's like a buffet made of life insurance. And what could be more delicious than that? Darrell Jones went to trial for Guillermo's murder on September 22, 1986. Just prior, prosecutors had offered him a plea deal in which he would spend just 6 years in prison, but he declined. His attorney was Kenneth Elias, and right away, Elias did something a little out of the ordinary. Instead of having Darrell sit beside him, he had him sit behind him in what's known as a prisoner's dock. He told the jurors, quote, "I like to be alone. I don't want to be distracted. A defendant sometimes gets excited by what's going on by testimony. Don't draw any conclusions because he's there and I'm here." Although they were never able to link Darrell to the gun or find any other direct evidence against him, prosecutors did have those eyewitnesses I referenced earlier. However, none of the witnesses identified Darrell as the shooter in court, and their testimony was contradictory and confusing at best. As they presented their evidence, prosecutors were able to establish the following. At about 10:30 p.m. on the night of the shooting, November 11, 1985, witnesses saw Guillermo Rodriguez, alongside a much shorter black man, walking across the street from a bar called Pete and Mary's to the D'Angelo's parking lot. The shorter black man was holding on to Guillermo and pushing him forward. When the two men got to the middle of the parking lot, the black man put a gun up to Guillermo and fired. Guillermo immediately fell to the ground, and the black man fled down a side street. Prosecutors were also able to establish that both Guillermo and Durrell had both been inside Pete and Mary's that night, although they were unable to establish any sort of connection between the two men. There were two vehicles in the D'Angelo's parking lot at the time that contained witnesses who saw the shooting. Paul Jones and his fiancée Denise Perkins were in one of them. They were sitting in their car eating sandwiches they had just purchased from D'Angelo's. Not only did they see the shooting, but they followed the shooter in their car up a side street before losing him and returning to the parking lot. Detective Donald Lagarde from the Brockton Police Department testified that he showed Denise an array of photos on two different dates after the shooting, on the following day and then 2 days later. He said both times Denise identified Durrell as the shooter, although he admitted that the first time she said she was not 100% sure. When Denise testified, she said that she did not identify Durrell the first time she was shown the photos, and that the second time, she had only narrowed it down to Durrell, and that he, quote, looked almost exactly like the guy I saw. She also said that prior to the shooting, she saw a black woman enter D'Angelo's, walk across the street to Pete and Mary's, and then return to D'Angelo's with the black man. The woman then left in a car, and the black man went back to Pete and Mary's. She said the black man she saw was the shooter. Her fiancé, Paul Jones, testified that he saw the same thing, although he said he wasn't sure he thought the man seen with the woman was the shooter. That woman they were referencing was likely Bridget Struthers, who testified that she was in Pete and Mary's that night and that she left to go to D'Angelo's to order a sandwich. She then went back to Pete and Mary's and went back to D'Angelo's with Durrell. She then left in a car while Durrell went back to Pete and Mary's. Detective Lagarde told the court that Durrell had lied to him when he first interviewed him on November 17, 1985. Durrell had told him that he did not leave Pete and Mary's prior to the shooting. He said a friend of his, whose name he didn't know, went across the street to D'Angelo's to get a sandwich for him, but that he stood in the doorway and waited for her to come back. He never left. The other vehicle that was in the D'Angelo's parking lot at the time of the shooting was occupied by five people who had just left Pete and Mary's: Walter Bobo Watson, Edna Levine, Terry Lynn Starks, Lisa Pina, and Alfred Moreau. After witnessing the shooting, they called an ambulance before leaving the scene. Terry Lynn Starks testified that after she and her friends left Pete and Mary's, they got into Bobo Watson's car. She said she saw a tall Cuban man and a shorter man cross the street. She had seen both of them earlier at Pete and Mary's. She said the shorter man was grabbing the taller man's jacket and had a gun in his right hand. About halfway through the parking lot, the shorter man raised the gun and the taller man fell to the ground. The shorter man then ran away. Terry told the court that a few weeks after the shooting, she gave a video-recorded interview to Detective Joseph Smith at the Brockton Police Station. During that interview, Detective Smith showed her an array of photos, and she chose which one she thought was the shooter. That video was played for the jury during Detective Smith's testimony, but partway through the video, as Terry is describing how the shorter of the two men had a gun, the interview is interrupted by an old television program called The Phil Silvers Show. After about 14 seconds, the video then returns to Terry's interview, where she describes how she was in the car and saw the shooting. But missing was her description and identification of the shooter. The jury was excused and Detective Smith was questioned about the error. This next bit of information will come up again later, so I'd like you to pay attention to what's said here, according to the transcripts. Detective Smith told the court that when he had played the video for Durrell's attorney, he had inadvertently pressed the record button rather than the play button. Elias asked him, "You mean you recorded something else over that tape while I was there?" And Detective Smith said yes. "And I knew that?" Elias asked. "Yeah, we discussed it," Detective Smith replied. Elias said he didn't remember that happening, but also noted that it was, quote, probably immaterial. And so the trial continued on, with Detective Smith telling the jury that in that videotape, during the missing part, Terry had identified Durrell as the shooter, even though she now wasn't saying that in court. Terry also testified that when she saw the two men crossing the street, she remarked, "That man is holding a gun on that other guy." She said her friend, Edna Levine, who was also in the car with her, replied, "That's Diamond. He used to stay at my house." But when Edna testified, she said she did not see the two men Terry described and that she never made that statement. In fact, she said she heard Terry say, "Edna, Diamond has a gun," something that Terry denied saying too. The other witnesses who were inside that second vehicle with Terry and Edna also testified. Lisa Pina said she heard either Edna or Terry say, "That damn Diamond," after the shooting. And when she asked who Diamond was, they said, "Never mind, Lisa, leave it alone. Never mind." Lisa also told the court that when Detective Smith showed her a lineup of photos, he insisted that she choose one. She said she reluctantly chose a photo that happened to be Durrell's, but she could not say that he was the shooter. Edna testified that she also identified Durrell in the photos, but also did not say he was the shooter. But despite the fact that both Lisa and Edna did not identify Durrell as the shooter and testified as such, Detective Smith testified earlier that they both had. Bobo Watson, another occupant of that second vehicle, testified that someone in the car mentioned the name Durrell Jones, not Diamond, but that he doesn't know who said it. Officer Richard Shanks, who also testified for the Commonwealth, said that after the shooting, he saw Durrell, whom he knew, exiting Pete and Mary's and standing outside the bar with a group of people. He said Durrell asked him what had happened, and he told him that someone had been shot. Later, he asked Denise Perkins and Paul Jones to look at everyone standing outside Pete and Mary's to see if they could identify any of them as the shooter. He said neither Denise nor Paul identified Durrell. And that was pretty much the gist of the prosecution's case. The defense called three witnesses to the stand, all of whom testified that Durrell was inside Pete and Mary's with them at the time of the shooting, eating a sub sandwich. On the third day of trial, Durrell's attorney, Kenneth Elias, told the judge that about 4 or 5 years earlier, he had represented three of the police officers who were witnesses in Durrell's trial in civil matters unrelated to the case. And he said there was one case with one of the officers that was actually still pending. The judge quickly asked Durrell if he had any objection to his attorney continuing to represent him, and Durrell said no, he wanted to keep him. After the closing arguments, the jury deliberated for about 4.5 hours before submitting a question to the judge. They asked for an instruction on the definition of reasonable doubt. They then continued to deliberate until about 4:30 the next day, when they reported that they were deadlocked. They were ordered to continue deliberating, and the day after that, they returned their verdict. They found Durrell guilty of first-degree murder. He was sentenced to life in prison without parole. Durrell's team filed an appeal, arguing that there was insufficient evidence identifying him as the shooter. They also argued that Detective Lagarde's testimony, where he told the court that Lisa Pina and Edna Levine had identified Durrell as the shooter in a photo lineup, even though Lisa and Edna both contradicted him, should not have been admitted. But in April of 1990, Durrell's appeal was denied and his conviction was upheld. 2 years later, in June 1992, Durrell's team filed a motion for a new trial on the grounds that his appellate attorney provided him with ineffective assistance of counsel. They said his attorney failed to argue that Durrell's waiver of his right to testify was invalid. Durrell said he had only decided not to testify because his trial attorney improperly told him that if he did testify, the prosecution could introduce evidence that he had failed a polygraph test. The motion for a new trial was denied. In the year 2000, Durrell's team tried again. They filed a second motion for a new trial. This time, they claimed ineffective assistance by both the trial and post-conviction attorneys for failing to raise the following claims. One, that Durrell's trial attorney improperly compelled him to sit in the prisoner's dock during trial. Two, that the court failed to properly question him concerning his right to testify prior to the polygraph. And three, that Durrell's trial attorney had a conflict of interest because he had also represented those police officers in civil matters. This motion was denied as well. But in October 2015, there was a huge breakthrough when Durrell's team, which now included new attorneys from the Massachusetts Innocence Program, filed a third motion for post-conviction relief. This time, they were granted a series of hearings. Lisa Kavanaugh, director of the Massachusetts Innocence Program, was confident that there were glaring issues in Durrell's case.
Really, at the at the outset, what I look for is really kind of guided by the study of wrongful convictions and what we know about the common causes of wrongful convictions. So when someone sends in an application, part of what I'm looking for is what were the factors that led to this person being convicted in the first place? So is this a case where there was identification evidence? Because we know that so many wrongful convictions are the result of erroneous identifications by eyewitnesses. Another very common source of wrongful convictions is forensic evidence that has been discredited. So, I'm at the front end looking at, are there some of these red flags that are reasons to look more closely at what was going on? And then, of course, is this person who's applying for our help, have they consistently said, I'm innocent, I don't belong here? So Durrell's case really had a lot of those elements. The only evidence against him at trial was not even in-court identifications, but a videotape of an eyewitness who had been interrogated by the police and identified a photograph on the videotape that tape that they said was Durrell's photograph. So that videotape was literally the only identification evidence that was used to convict him. There was no motive. There was no physical evidence that connected him. So it really had this, it resonated as a case that really needed to be looked at more closely. One of the other things that we look for and that we see again and again, sadly, is bad lawyering, sort of conflicts of interest and just inadequate defense by trial lawyers. So Durrell's case also had that in a very extreme fashion. You had his trial lawyer who was, at the time of his representation of Durrell, was also representing several of the police officers who were involved in investigating the case and who turned out to be the central witnesses at trial. So you had this, clear conflict of interest that was not revealed to Durrell until midway through the trial and then was handled in this very inappropriate and inadequate way by the trial judge. So that was another really important factor that in Durrell's case made it clear that we needed to look at this more closely.
As for why the conflict of interest was such a huge issue in Lisa's mind, the entire crux of the Commonwealth's case was based on the credibility of those police officers. And it would stand to reason that if Durrell's attorney had a relationship with them as well, then maybe he wouldn't question them as vigorously or as properly as he should have.
One of many things that was really unusual about Durrell's case is you had a whole bunch of people who were there when the shooting happened and who gave descriptions of the person they'd seen, and he didn't match the description. And so not surprisingly, in court, none of them identified him, in our view, because he wasn't the person they'd seen. But the police officers were called to testify that out of court, on a prior occasion, they had identified, or some of them had identified him. And so, in other words, the credibility of these detectives was the absolutely most important thing in the case. And to have a lawyer who was representing those detectives and who therefore had a reason not to push them too hard was... this wasn't just a theoretical problem. It was the central problem in the whole case.
But in addition to that, Lisa and her team had other issues they argued in their motion too, six in all. One of them was their allegation that police had tampered with evidence, namely that videotaped interview of Terry Lynn Starks, where it cut out just as she was describing the shooter.
But at the core was this idea that the police had deliberately tampered with the only piece of evidence that provided an identification at trial.
They also contended that there was a Brady violation, that the Commonwealth had failed to provide a report written by Detective Lagarde to the defense team prior to trial, and that there was ineffective assistance of counsel. For example, that Durrell's trial attorney didn't question how the witnesses had described the shooter as being much shorter than Guillermo, about 6 inches to a foot shorter. When in fact, Durrell was about the same height as Guillermo. They were both around 6'1". They also argued that there had been significant changes in witness identification procedures, meaning that the way in which these particular eyewitnesses identified the shooter would not be done in the same manner today.
You know, what we were able to show was that literally everything that police officers are now taught not to do, all of the things, sort of the laundry list of things that contribute to error, all of them were done here. And you had all kinds of issues that we now know impede witnesses from making reliable observations, you know, sort of the dark and the weapon focus and all of the different factors that make it hard for witnesses to make reliable observations at the time they're witnessing an event.
And the last reason actually came about after they had filed their motion and were starting to litigate it in court. While they were doing that, reporters at WBUR took notice of the case and started conducting some in-depth coverage of the original trial, of Durrell's appeal efforts, and of the motions that had just been filed by Lisa and her team. One of the reporters, Bruce Gellerman, ended up finding one of the jurors from the trial, Eleanor Urbati, and Eleanor had quite a story to tell.
She was at the time in her 80s, and you know, he described his first encounter with her as though she had been waiting for someone to come and find her. So he had a very striking first conversation with her, and then she agreed to go on video and be interviewed. And she told this very kind of heart-wrenching story about how she had walked into the deliberation room right after the closings, and they'd taken kind of a straw poll of who voted, you know, who was leaning toward guilty, who was leaning toward not guilty. And there were two, it was an all-white jury, she was white as well, and two of the jurors, two white men, indicated that they were inclined to vote guilty. And she said, well, why is that? Is it because he's black? And they said yes. And she had this, you know, it was like it had happened yesterday. She had just this very vivid recollection of it, which she stood by. So ultimately, we ended up amending our motion to include a claim that there had been racial bias in the jury deliberation. And we were able to do that because there had been an important U.S. Supreme Court case that came down while our motion was pending. So, you know, gave us sort of a new legal vehicle to raise this issue. And then the judge held a hearing, and several of the jurors, including Ms. Urbati, came in and testified. So not only did she give a statement on video for the reporters, but ultimately she came in and testified under oath before the judge who was considering the motion. And she just, you know, throughout, she was very clear that this is what had happened. There was actually news coverage at the time of the verdict indicating that one of the jurors, a female, was sobbing during the reading of the jury verdict. And so she disclosed that that was her. And she was the one who was so wrought at the time that the verdict was read because she was upset even at the time. So it was very powerful and moving to have her participate in this way. I know it was actually very intense for Durrell to sit there during her testimony and to, you know, to sort of face this person who had been part of the verdict that sent him to prison for 32 years, but who was there kind of sharing her truth about what had happened and how awful she felt about it ever since.
The fact that the judge allowed for a hearing on that issue was definitely out of the norm in Massachusetts, where they typically don't allow attorneys to contact jurors or to revisit the deliberations.
I'd never been a part of a post-trial hearing where jurors were being called back and questioned about their deliberation process. It's normally, you know, forbidden. The jury deliberation process is viewed as sacrosanct, and you don't you don't penetrate it. You don't question about, you don't question it, certainly not in court, unless it comes out that there's evidence of one of a very few kinds of misconduct, racial bias being one of them.
As I said earlier, the judge granted a series of hearings relating to Lisa and her team's motion for a new trial. And in one of those hearings, the issue of police tampering with evidence was argued. Remember that videotape of Terry Lynn Starks' interview? And remember how, at Durrell's trial, Detective Smith said that he had accidentally pushed record? Well, now in this hearing, Detective Smith was saying that he actually didn't know what had happened, that he had only been giving his best guess when he testified about the error at Durrell's trial. After the hearings were over, in 2017, the judge had made his decision. Durrell's conviction would be vacated, and he would be granted a new trial. According to the judge's ruling, he sided with the defense on two of the six issues: that Detective Smith provided false testimony about that videotape, and that certain members of the jury were racially biased. Upon hearing the news, Lisa and the two other attorneys on the team went to the prison where Durrell was being held and met with him. They had been there many times before for many different meetings, but this one was different.
The whole thing was really surreal because the three of us had been there many times before to talk about the motion and to talk through strategy. And we'd had lots of long meetings, some of them full of arguments. And, you know, we'd had all of these intense prior meetings with Durrell, and we were in the same exact space. The way that Susan Baranowski visiting room is set up, it's a big, large open room for when they have visitors. And then they have a series of small attorney rooms along one side of the room. So we were in one of those attorney rooms waiting for him to come out. And when he came in, I don't know what he thought. I don't think he was expecting to hear one way or the other about the motion. But we just sort of, you know, it was just like the judge allowed the motion. And he kind of almost collapsed against the wall. He was so overcome. And, you know, he's not someone who's frequently speechless. He's very articulate and, you know, a forceful speaker, but he was momentarily speechless because it was just such a powerful moment for him.
Durrell was released from prison, and Lisa was there when he took his first steps outside. But their happiness and relief that he was out would be short-lived because prosecutors weren't done trying the case against him. More on that after this quick break from today's sponsors. What is the bra women are talking about? The original True Body Bra by TrueAndCo.com. Over 500,000 women have bought it and swear by it, including me and a bunch of my friends. It took over 6 years of collecting data from 7 million women to make this game-changing bra. You will not believe how good it looks when you put it on. The buttery soft fabric smooths you out in all the right places. And you know what's game-changing? The best-selling True Body collection now comes in over 70 wire-free options. Choose from scoop or V-neck, convertible straps, bright colors, neutrals, skin tones, and more. You'll want them all. No wonder TrueAndCo.com has sold over 500,000 of the original True Body bras. The Today Show calls it game-changing. Good Housekeeping says it's the ultimate lounge bra. And Real Simple Magazine says it provides heavenly 24-hour comfort. Try the original True Body bra from True & Co. today with free and easy returns. Save 15% now when you go to TrueAndCo.com/junkie and enter the code junkie. That's TrueAndCo.com. There are a million things demanding your time, and contact lenses shouldn't be one of them. Simple Contacts is the most convenient way to renew your contact lens prescription and reorder your brand of contacts from anywhere in minutes. This isn't a replacement for your periodic full eye health exam, but it is a great way to skip the office visit for something you wear every day. The Simple Contacts vision test is self-guided and takes less than 5 minutes. After it's reviewed by a licensed doctor, you receive a renewed prescription and reorder your contacts. Simple Contacts has all the brands and types of lenses you're familiar with, so you never have to shop around to find the best price. The vision test is only $20 compared to the hundreds you'd spend at an appointment, and the contact lens prices are unbeatable. Plus, standard shipping is free. The reviews speak for themselves. Simple Contacts has been rated 5 stars over 5,000 times on the App Store. I've been a Simple Contacts customer for well over a year now, and I just love how easy and convenient it is, especially with my busy schedule. I'll be honest, I wouldn't really be looking forward to going to the eye doctor with my 1-year-old daughter in tow just to get new contacts. So this works out perfectly for me. Not to mention the amount of money I'm saving by not having to leave the house, not having to pay for an office visit, and by getting the best deals on my contacts. Get $20 off of your contacts at simplecontacts.com/junkie20 or enter code junkie20 at checkout. That's simplecontacts.com/junkie20 or enter code junkie20 for $20 off your contacts. In March 2019, prosecutors announced that they were definitely going to retry Durrell. Lisa and Durrell happened to be in Atlanta at the Innocence Network conference when they got the news. Lisa wasn't completely surprised, but she was disappointed. Durrell wasn't surprised at all. Before Durrell's retrial began, however, prosecutors approached him with a plea deal. He could plead guilty to manslaughter and would be sentenced to time served. He would be a free man and wouldn't have to worry about being tried ever again. But again, Durrell declined.
During one of the kind of final pretrial conferences, that the prosecutor made a point of putting it on the record in open court so that it was recorded that she was making this offer. And, you know, almost as though she was just in disbelief, you know, like maybe we hadn't communicated it to him. Maybe he hadn't thought about it yet. And so then he put on the record, you know, right then and there that he was not accepting the deal and that he wanted to go to trial.
Going to trial would be a huge gamble. If found guilty, Durrell would find himself right back in prison. But Lisa said he never wavered in his decision. He wasn't going to plead guilty to something he said he didn't do. And so he was willing to take that chance. Preparing for the new trial, which started in June 2019, wasn't easy. On day one of the trial, Lisa quickly realized that finding an impartial jury, which was now in Plymouth County, would be challenging.
Race played a very potent role in the original trial, and it also played a potent role in the retrial. You know, we had a very intense jury selection process, and I mean, ultimately, I think we all felt good about the jurors who sat on the jury, but the process of getting there was really kind of disturbing. Plymouth County is, so this, the crime happened in Brockton, and Brockton is the, you know, is an urban center. It has roughly 50% of Brockton residents are people of color. So, you know, if you were to try a case drawing on Brockton residents, you would expect to have a fairly diverse cross-section of potential jurors. But Plymouth County as a whole has much lower percentage of people of color. And so you had, like the first day of trial, I don't remember all of the details, but I know that we had, well, on the first day of jury selection, we had something like a total of 6 out of 80 who were people of color and maybe 2 Black potential jurors. On the second day, we had, you know, 40-something potential jurors, and they were all white, every single one of them. And so we did file a motion to strike the venare, which is the mechanism for saying, essentially, we're not getting a fair cross-section. So you should dismiss this venare. We should start all over. The judge denied it, I guess he didn't deny it. He withheld decision. He didn't take action on it. And ultimately, we did see 2 jurors of color. And it's complicated because I think it's not a question of, you can't assume that every person of color will have the same view of evidence. But, and Durrell's perspective, you know, all of ours was we want people from all different backgrounds. You know, it's not just about having a racially diverse jury. It's about having a socioeconomically diverse and a, you know, gender diverse and a age diverse and a life experience diverse jury. And that was really hard to accomplish given the jury pool that we had. But it absolutely played a really powerful role throughout the case. And I think we were all sensitized to it, given the history of this first trial with an all-white jury and the evidence of jury bias in the deliberations, that we were all thinking about how can we take steps to not repeat history here.
I asked what the jury knew about Durrell's first trial.
We actually wanted to be candid, and we thought that it was better for the potential jurors to know that. The judge ended up telling them that there had been a prior proceeding, and so there were questions about whether they would make any assumptions one way or the other based on the fact that there had been a prior proceeding. But, you know, I mean, there was nothing normal about this trial. So, the jury selection process was really challenging. It took several days. There were a lot of very intense emotional moments.
In addition to making sure they didn't have the same juror issues as before, the defense also had additional hurdles to overcome. In a rather surprising move, the judge had ruled that instead of recalling some of the same eyewitnesses to the stand, the prosecution would be allowed to just read the transcripts of their testimony from the first trial. At first, prosecutors had requested to do this because many witnesses, such as the medical examiner, one of the lead detectives, and two eyewitnesses, had since passed away. But then there were three other eyewitnesses who had since come forward and provided affidavits in support of Durrell's new trial. And the judge ruled that those witnesses could be replaced with the transcripts from their initial trial testimony as well. Here's how that particular part went down. The defense had filed a motion to suppress the prior trial's testimony from three witnesses, Lisa Pina, Terry Lynn Starks, and Edna Levine. All three witnesses testified at that pretrial hearing, and all three either said that they were pressured into identifying Durrell or that they could not remember. Lisa Pina said that she couldn't recall any of the details of the shooting, not even what she had testified to at the original trial. She also accused Detective Smith of having badgered her into identifying Durrell from the photo lineup he had showed her. Terry Lynn Starks told the judge that she couldn't remember anything from that night either. She said she had been on drugs and was drunk that night. She also testified that she had been arrested on outstanding prostitution warrants after the murder and that she was held in jail without bail so detectives could get her to identify a photo of Durrell. Edna Levine testified that Detective Smith had threatened her with jail time and told her that he would take her son away from her if she didn't ID Durrell in a photo lineup he showed her. But the judge in the case, Judge Cornelius Moriarty, didn't think that the three witnesses were credible with what they were saying now. And so he admonished them, telling them that, quote, perjury in a murder case is a serious offense. He then assigned each one a court-appointed attorney and told them to speak with their attorneys about their future testimony. In the end, the three refused to testify at the new trial, and so the judge ruled that their prior testimony from the first trial could be used by prosecutors instead. Lisa explains further.
Three or four witnesses who had provided affidavits in support of his new trial motion and really largely had just reinforced some of the very problematic tactics that the police had used to interact with them back at the time of the investigation. But the judge held a hearing and ultimately concluded that they had a Fifth Amendment privilege because of the possibility that they could be charged with perjury for testifying inconsistently in some respects with what they had said at the time of trial. So the prosecutor was able to essentially kick them off the stand by finding that they were unavailable, and then to use their prior testimony. So in the end, not a single eyewitness testified from the stand.
And so the majority of the prosecution's witnesses in the retrial were actually people who were not the witnesses, but who were reading transcripts of what was said in the first trial from the stand.
Virtually the Commonwealth's entire case came in through reading the transcripts of the original trial witnesses. So, you know, they had a whole bunch of employees of the DA's office who came in and sat in the stand, and then they read. The prosecutor would read the question and the witness would read the answer.
This meant that the defense wouldn't be able to cross-examine any of them. Lisa said they refused to participate in this. that they declined to read the transcripts of the trial attorney's cross-examination, and so the prosecutor read it out loud instead.
This was all over our objection. We contended, why should he be stuck with the original terrible job that his trial lawyer did? Why are we just reenacting that original unfair trial? And we actually filed a motion that said something like, you know, motion to prevent an unfair reenactment of the original, of the original conflict trial or something like that. But it was, you know, our point was, why are we doing this? Why are we retrying him using a transcript of what we all can agree was an unfair trial? But that's exactly what happened.
I asked Lisa how they were able to defend Durrell if they couldn't even do cross-examinations of the witnesses.
Well, it was interesting. So, you know, several of the eyewitnesses had testified at, we moved to suppress their out-of-court identifications because, you know, you remember none of these eyewitnesses came to court at trial back in the 80s and identified him from the stand. None of them. So the only ID evidence, arguably, was whatever they had said to the police officers out of court. And we had moved to suppress those because we said the way those procedures were handled was so unreliable that it shouldn't be admitted into evidence. We lost that motion, but the witnesses, the same ones who were found to have a Fifth Amendment privilege, they testified at the suppression hearing. So we were able to offer some limited, you know, basically we said, well, this is our version of a cross-examination. We want to read into the record the things that they said at that suppression hearing that we, you know, that didn't come out at the time of the original trial and that we would consider to be the equivalent of cross-examining them if they were here. And so the judge did allow us to do a little bit of that. And that was, to the extent that we participated at all in the sort of charade of reading witnesses, it was to read in the evidence that had been brought out by us at the suppression hearing.
By all accounts, the way this retrial played out was abnormal. And it wasn't just Lisa and the rest of Durrell's defense team that seemed to have reservations about having this retrial at all.
One of the most striking moments in the whole experience was right after we finished picking the jury. So the jury, you know, it was Thursday afternoon and we were going to start the trial on Friday. And the judge called us over to sidebar. And he basically said, he turned to the prosecutor and, you know, on the one hand, he was going out of his way to say, I'm not trying to tell you how to do your job. But, you know, in light of what we now know, in light of the, you know, the tampered evidence and the conflict of interest and the changes in identification, don't you think that it, and the fact that he spent 32 years in prison, don't you think that it might not be in the interest of justice to dismiss the charges? Have you considered that? And, you know, not surprisingly, she said, you know, no, that's not, you know, we don't think that's what should happen here. That's why we offered him a plea to manslaughter. So that was their view of justice.
Testimony only went on for 2 days. Prosecutors didn't have anything new to introduce. No evidence tying Durrell to the murder, and no evidence that the two even knew each other. So they were basically just reading the transcripts from the first trial. The question was, what would the jury think about it? On June 11th, 2019, after just 2 hours of deliberation, the jury announced that they had reached their verdict.
When the defendant is charged with the crime of murder, is he guilty or not guilty?
Not guilty.
Not guilty. After the verdict was read, Durrell, who was now 52 years old and finally truly free, thanked the jury. He then spoke to reporters.
I'm celebrating the fact that I'm free, but I don't celebrate that they set me free. That's right. Because they shouldn't have had me anyway.
He was asked by WBUR about what he was thinking as he waited for the verdict to be read.
You know, my mind was just thinking the gamble, right? You know, I'm standing for my principle. I'm standing for what I know I didn't do. I'm standing for what I know is right. And I felt like that was the way to expose them. That's why I didn't take their deals, because I'm saying I have to go all the way for the next guy or the next woman that's in Framingham or wherever. I have to do it. But it's hard when you realize that behind you is your sister and, you know, and your girl and different people and, you know, family and friends and my dad. I'm thinking about them. you know, that's all I could think about was, did I just put them in the situation to be separated again from them because I have to go through this? But I think they understood. I just had to. I couldn't let it go. I thought about it in prison too long, you know, and new trial was the way to go. They did it to me in secret in the past, and people didn't know I was there. And I think that's one of the issues. No one knows that we're there until we end up in the situation of getting out.
After the trial, many of the jurors expressed shock after learning that Durrell had served 32 years in prison for the murder. One of the jurors said the prosecution was nowhere close to proving that Durrell had done it. Another said he was stunned when he found out that Durrell had already served time. He said he hopes Durrell, quote, gets some damn compensation. According to reports, Durrell will be able to seek $1 million from Massachusetts for his wrongful conviction, and even more in federal court. The Plymouth County District Attorney's Office, however, seemed to stand by their decision to prosecute. They released a statement after the verdict saying, quote, we respect the jury's decision, but with the passage of 3 decades, the deaths of necessary witnesses, and exclusion of some of the prior evidence that was used at the 1986 trial, this was an incredibly difficult case to retry. They said as prosecutors, that is their job, seeking justice for victims. Lisa Kavanaugh, though successful with Durrell's case, still has more work to do, and she has a podcast that chronicles some of her clients and that I think you guys will particularly enjoy.
Working with 2 of my folks who've been posted with me as legal fellows created a podcast called Mass Exoneration, and it's now available. We ended up creating 5 episodes, and they've all been released. They're on, you know, on iTunes, and I think we're now on Spotify. So basically anywhere where you can get your podcast, you can get Mass Exoneration. And the idea behind it was basically a recognition that often when you hear and read about wrongful conviction cases, you don't hear about how the kind of the ripple effects of how much they harm entire families and communities. And you don't often hear about what prison is like for someone who spends decades behind bars for something that they didn't do, what that does to them, what that does to their family. And then also, because I work in Massachusetts and I partner with the New England Innocence Project, which is my nonprofit counterpart, we thought it was important to have a podcast that was dedicated to wrongfully convicted people in Massachusetts, to highlight that, you know, we sort of think of ourselves in Massachusetts as being more progressive, more liberal, you know, that the problems of wrongful convictions are things that mostly occur in other states. And this was intended to dispel that and to kind of normalize the idea that this is our problem too, and we should be ashamed in our state, and we should also own and learn from the stories of the people who've been wrongfully convicted in Massachusetts. And the podcast really looks at a pretty wide range of different kinds of life experiences, because it's not like there's one cookie cutter experience that everybody has. So we started with an episode that was focused on one of my other clients, Fred Clay, and his experience being wrongfully convicted at the age of 16 and then spending 38 years in prison and, you know, losing contact with his entire family and, you know, building a new family, essentially. And we also took a look at another client who had young children and experienced being a father for 16 years through the visiting room. And so, you know, we really tried to focus on different stories and different people's experiences to highlight all of the ways that we have so much in common with the people who are the subject of the stories.
And that's all for today's episode. I'd love to know your thoughts on this case. Do you think the prosecutor should have gone ahead with the retrial? What did you make of Durrell declining the plea deals each and every time they were offered? For you, does that say something about his innocence? What are your thoughts on how the retrial was handled? Let me know by tweeting me at CourtJunkiePod, by joining our conversation on Instagram at Court Junkie, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. I'm putting my complete interview with Lisa Kavanaugh up on Patreon as additional content for my $10 a month patrons. I'm also going to be adding the rest of my conversation with Dan Abrams on there as well. where you can hear me fangirl out and ask him questions about Live PD. You can find those on courtjunkie.com/support, which will redirect you to my Patreon page. If you guys have any questions about this new deal with Law and Crime Network, please feel free to reach out to me too, and I'm happy to answer any and all questions you have. I'll be doing a Q&A on Instagram too about it, so keep an eye out for that. Lastly, thank you to my sponsors from today's show, especially True & Co., which is one of my favorite sponsors. You will not believe how good the original True Body Bra by TrueAndCo.com looks when you put it on. And the best-selling True Body collection now comes in over 70 wire-free options, including scoop neck, V-neck, convertible straps, and more. You will want them all. No wonder the Today Show calls it game-changing, Good Housekeeping says it's the ultimate lounge bra, and Real Simple Magazine says it provides heavenly 24-hour comfort. Try the original True Body Bra from True & Co. today with free and easy returns. Save 15% now when you go to trueandco.com/junkie and enter the code JUNKIE. That's TrueAndCo.com. And that's all for today's show. Thanks for listening. Until next time.